Totally Football Show. Today, Manchester. It's like the Roses and the Mondays all over again. Two Mancunian outfits, number one with their amazing records. We ask, is Marouane Fellaini, Bez with big hair, looks a bit useless but actually vital for a good performance, and can anyone harsh their mellow? Elsewhere, just when you thought it was safe to go back to Wembley, Spurs have more trouble at home, and that Chelsea-Arsenal match. We'll talk Championship, Birmingham fire Harry Redknapp after 4 points in 8 games. We ask any way Wandy Ramos can come in and take them into Europe, and we'll be getting the latest from football abroad, Scotland, Russia, Italy and Germany. It's the Totally Football Show. On today's panel, Raphael Honigstein's back, Rafa.
Hello.
Hello there. But we've got season debut for Sasha Gurionov.
Hello, James.
A.k.a. Slasher.
Hi, James.
Hi again. And also, and this is exciting, fresh in from the Independent, Simon Hughes, known to you as the best-selling author of the excellent Men in White Suits, and soon to be dominating the book charts once again with On the Brink, A Journey Through English Football's Northwest.
Hello.
Hi, Simon. That's nice. Is the title part of the word count? Is that how you kind of...
I just found it quite hard to come up with something that sums up the Northwest, to be honest, and it just felt like everybody was on the brink.
On the brink.
Yeah, that's why.
We're going to be talking about On the Brink teams from the Northwest, so it's perfect to have you here. I mean, Manchester teams in general, both Man United and City, with absolutely extraordinary records, because identical right now, 13 points earned, 16 goals scored, only two conceded, 10 from the pair of them this weekend. Do you know, United and City are together are responsible for more than a quarter of all the goals scored in the Premier League this season.
Wow.
Yeah.
James, who would you rather watch?
Out of those two? Well, personally, City. Who would you rather watch, Sasha?
Definitely City.
Mm. And why is that?
Well, they play well throughout, as opposed to Manchester United. 1-0, going last 10 and then score another 3. I'd rather get my 90 minutes worth of entertainment.
Mm. Dave Newton says, I think we need to look into Man City in general, as they always seem to have an extra man sneaking 12 on the pitch. Now, there were many stars in their rout of Watford at the weekend. I think David Silva, so underrated as a player, really deserves some recognition here. Aguero, with the hat-trick, pretty good as well. He's only 3 off their all-time scoring record now. But it was Pep decided that the players he wanted to cite for commendation with the fullbacks, essentially.
Yeah, which of course has a political dimension, because he had been criticised for spending so heavily on fullbacks, which is kind of seen as sort of an indictment of his method, saying, you know, if he's so good, why does he has to spend so much money on fullbacks? But of course, A, he doesn't really care personally. I don't think City care very much what the money's being spent on. And they very clearly needed different type of fullbacks because the ones that they had before weren't quite good enough to play that kind of expensive football that he wanted. So with Pep, knowing from Bayern, you cannot really take anything serious when it comes to him commanding players, because he praises every single player and usually then they're gone a couple of weeks later. The best one, and you might have heard this one before, is when he said, I'd like to have 1,000 Dantes in my squad. And then Dante was gone. And so he's very generous in his praise, but it doesn't mean all that much, because you hear it again and again said about every single person in the squad.
But if there is a difference between City this year and last year, would it be the fullbacks?
Well, the fullbacks are, of course, different players. Yes, so there is a difference, but I just think his methods work better. I mean, it's not long ago when you saw pundits regularly trying to give him advice how he should be setting up his defence, and he's just not really understanding how it should be done. His answer, of course, was always, I do things a little bit differently, and if it doesn't work, it's not because the method is wrong, it's because the application is wrong. And maybe, I think we'll get to Jurgen Klopp, I think his view is similar. On you know, on how coaching works and doesn't work. So I think that the kind of stuff that he's been trying to work hard on, which is the prevention of counter-attacks deep in the opposition half, things that really just take a bit of time, is coming more to fruition now. And they have the best squad. I think no one really doubts that. And, you know, they were the favourites to win the Premier League before the season kicked off.
Were they?
Yes, they were. There's no surprise that they are leading the table.
They did also have a similar result against Watford last year in this fixture. It was 5-0 that time. And Watford also had a raft of players, which is a strange collective now, actually. But anyway, a group of players out injured at the back.
Also for me, you know, interaction between Aguero and Jesus. I think they played 8 games together. I think Aguero got eight goals. Jesus got 7 and 5 assists between each other. Last 2 games as well, we're seeing Aguero setting up Jesus for the goals. Maybe a question for Rafa. What do you make of Guardiola's treatment last year of Aguero and where he is now?
Guardiola was very unhappy with the way Aguero behaved off the ball. He didn't offer enough. In a way, I think it's not so much that Aguero has changed his game, but the formation with Jesus behind Aguero allows Aguero just to do a little bit less without attracting the ire of Guardiola. They don't have to work so hard because A, he's got the extra man, and B, they have these 5 guys across the middle. So they don't have to win the ball back quite as high as before. They have a bit more solidity at the back when they play with 3 at the back, which is a 5 without possession. And, you know, as a goal scorer, he's still the most natural goal scorer, I think, in the Premier League. Full stop. So I don't think necessarily much has changed. I think it's just that they, let's say, found a way to work with each other that's to the benefit of everyone.
I think it's a really good thing for Aguero to have somebody up front with him, because
every striker
over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, how many years he's been in England now, he's often played up front by himself. You know, when you have to do that, you're getting kicked every week, and I think that's impacted on the number of games that he can play. I actually think if he has somebody up there with him, he's going to actually be able to play more games, because there's just simply more for the defenders to think about rather than him.
I mean, for me, like the best moment I've seen Aguero and Jesus do this season was what they did to Clavin on the opening goal at City, where basically they're just standing either side of Clavin, completely isolating him, and then Aguero just runs through, so in playing together well.
Right,
but it was Ragnar Clavin.
True.
Fair point.
We'll come to him. Yeah.
Also,
but pick out the weaknesses.
When you look at Man United's win, just the 4 for them, do you have to throw in that it was also Everton in that?
No, I think that'd be a bit harsh. I mean, Everton played well through large spells. They made it rather difficult for most of the time. I think they just fell apart a little bit at the end. I think United still look exactly the way they have looked from the very first moment of the season, where they don't concede a lot of goals. They look very pragmatic. They have quality up front. They have a kind of a cynical streak, or maybe we should say clinical streak, put it in more positive terms. They do things differently than City, but they do them just as well. On their own terms.
Right.
And that's why, again, they are up there. And I don't think that's a big surprise either, that those two clubs are challenging for the title.
Right. Stylistically, as you say, very different. Man United have scored more than half their goals this season after the 80th minute. But it was the one they scored very early on through Antonio Valencia that really caught the eye this time.
Fantastic finish. I mean, I know it might have actually come off his shin a little bit.
Did it?
I know... You know, at half time, that the pundits were talking about the technique. I think Thierry Henry and Graeme Souness were pointing out that the technique was absolutely perfect, which it was. And I think he's become a really, you know, important player for United as well. You know, they've got strength and experience across the team now. There's no, I know Mourinho gets criticised, doesn't he, for not bringing through young players, but all the players that they've got are kind of at the right age now. And Valencia is one of them. You know, he's been there for a long time. He's probably the most consistent right back in the league. Rarely misses a game. Scores a few goals, you know.
Few is the word. Actually, you know, the last time he scored a goal was January 2014.
All right, well, he completely shot that one down. But
no, but he is a tremendously consistent performer, definitely.
Yeah,
Everton, not so much. Down in the bottom 3 now. 4 defeats in a row. They've conceded 12 goals without reply. Dan Mason, among the many people commenting wryly this weekend, good job, Everton. Did all that good business in the summer. They'd be in trouble otherwise. It's mighty similar to another Dutch manager who we've just recently waved goodbye to in terms of a record.
Is actually Everton's record worse than Palace's?
It might be, yeah. In terms of goals conceded, it might well be. But having said that, easier fixtures on the way. In fact, many listeners asking, is it just because of the rotten opening games that Everton had? Because they did have a tough fixture list. They've got, I think, 4 home matches in a row coming up. Is that going to change their fortunes?
But they don't. I mean, for me, watching Everton, I only saw the highlights of the United game. Just slow. I mean, it's very slow transitions, very slow the way they move the ball forward, which makes it basically easier to defend against them. Maybe that's why they haven't scored any goals. I mean, Rooney did have a couple of chances yesterday, but overall, I think, you know, if this carries on, it's just the oomph is completely going out of the club.
Yeah, a worrying performance last Thursday as well in the Europa League away at Atalanta. But yeah, and a worrying run of form for Everton, their sleeve sponsor, drawing a lot of comment too. Uncle Nonny's saying, "New Everton, Angry Birds," it says now on their sleeves. New Everton sleeve sponsor summing up Rooney's personal life.
I think Everton are the victim of totally unwarranted hype before the start of the season. You know, they bought some decent players, but it was very clear, at least to me, that there is a glass ceiling that they cannot possibly break through. They were never going to challenge for the top four, I think. They were never going to challenge for the title. Of course, they started off badly, but they've lost against teams that you'd expect them to lose against.
So. What Sasha's pointed towards, though, is not just the fact that they've lost, but there seems to be almost a lack of fight, would you say?
I mean, I think with every defeat, I mean, if you look at the club that enters a rut, you know, you start believing less and less in what the manager is asking you to do, and it just sucks the life out of you.
All right. Anyway, Man United and Man City looking good. It's early. We'd prefer to watch Man City. Which do we think is more likely in the long run?
More likely to win the title? I think it'll come down to a couple of points either way. I think it'll be that close.
Simon?
I think United this season.
Did you write your book a year too early? Anyway, there you go. It's 10 goals for the two Mancunian sides. Absolutely none for London's teams. And we'll be looking at that after this. Hey, listeners, if you want to see what we look like, head over to Facebook and search for The Totally Football Show. There are some very nice videos on there, too. It's what people who run media companies call bonus content. Oh, and also, don't forget, we're going out on the road, the M6, to be precise, Simon. Although we might take the M40 if we want to go the scenic route, and also you skip the toll that way. But anyway, our destination is the Glee Club in Birmingham on Wednesday, November the 8th, and this is for our first ever Totally Football Live. That's very exciting, and if you'd like to get a ticket, all I can do is urge you to go post-haste to glee.co.uk and get one of those hot potatoes as soon as possible.
James, why don't you just take the train?
Well, that's also an option, isn't it? Yeah, I think I'll take the train. So we'll be hitting the rails and perhaps going off them. I don't know. It's that kind of crazy evening when we go Totally Football Live, I think. Sorry, Sasha. Arsenal. How? Why? What's happening? Rafa?
A competent performance from Arsenal.
Well, two, actually, because they came from behind against Cologne in that Europa League on Thursday.
Yeah, but that was a shambolic performance, all told. This one was good, and they did something that most people didn't think they were capable of, which is to just keep it tight, not concede any stupid goals, try to pick their moments when going forward. I did think they looked quite shaky in the opening 20 minutes or so and could have easily conceded. But overall, it's the kind of performance that instills a bit of confidence that if maybe not things changing dramatically, that they're at least not getting worse, that they sort of can keep their level. Yeah, you have to give them credit. But the way that they showed Chelsea's limitations in the cup final, where I think if you prepare very well for that, for the Chelsea game, which is the ball over the top most of the time, early ball or from Fabregas in this case, then they don't have that much else to offer.
We saw a glorious example of that early on with Fabregas over the top.
Yeah.
But Arsenal keeping their first clean sheet at Stamford Bridge in 12 years. Is it a coincidence that these two but moral victory, if you like, at the weekend and the win over Cologne have come without Ozil in the side?
I don't know.
You put in a Iwobi,
it's a coincidence.
The extra movement. I would hesitate to come down on Ozil because that would only reveal me to be a football unsophisticate. But it is interesting that the team seem to have a greater dynamism, be more physical perhaps. They almost seem to be the more physical of the two teams, which I didn't expect at all.
I mean, look, he played in the final when Arsenal beat Chelsea.
Right.
So I don't know if he necessarily makes a huge difference. But what is true undoubtedly is that if you want to play without the ball, and that seemed to be a mindset that Wenger for once was comfortable with in this game, then you're better off without Ozil. Because without the ball and no strategy to win it back, he gets lost, and others are happier to suffer and to, you know, condense space and do all the kind of stuff that perhaps is not his natural game.
Right. No Costa, no Diego Costa, which, again, people are pointing
Breaking
towards.
News.
Yeah. But is that Is this an example of why?
I think it's an example of people trying to find an angle for a 0-0 game, something to write about. Morata was very good, I felt, and just didn't score. I mean, it can happen that a striker doesn't score.
I do think, though, the Chelsea midfielders and the players around him are still getting used to Morata. You know, he's a very good player, very talented player, but, you know, I think if you look at the way Chelsea played last year, Costa was so integral to the style of football. It's just going to take a little bit of time for that to bed down.
That's fair.
I was at the game and I had the feeling at the very start that Chelsea were very, very confident that they're just going to do Arsenal here 2-3-0. And when Arsenal actually showed that composure and that compact shape, Chelsea were a bit taken. I had the feeling Chelsea were a little bit taken aback by this. And actually, if you look at the sort of the diagram of formations after the game that they had the match of the day, the Arsenal formation was actually very, very rigid. So they really, really stuck to what they were doing. And then once they got over the sort of initial 15, 20 minutes of Chelsea, you know, probing and stuff, they actually did reasonably well. And I thought Bellerin got behind Alonso on two or three occasions very nicely, and they perhaps should have opened the scoring. Ramsey waddled through just before halftime. He runs very weirdly with the ball. He hit the post. And I thought in the second half, sort of they just matched each other very, very well. And what Wenger said after the game is that it was important to at least not lose. And you could see, I think, that in their approach in the last 20 minutes. And then, of course, Sanchez returned, needled Luis. Luis lost his head and got sent off. So I think almost at the end, they were also psychological winners as well. I think certainly after the game, Conte was quite downbeat after the game. And he was being asked about, you know, why are you picking up all these red cards? And he was like...
It's 3-5 now in the Premier League after 3 in their previous 73.
He didn't really like the questions and he sort of tried to bat them back and buy himself a bit of time, but he didn't really offer an explanation for this.
Right, and they're going to miss Luis for three games now, which includes the Man City.
Yeah, so this was a straight red. You know, there was also the controversy, I think it was a 52nd minute, where he kicked Koscielny in the face. And again, there was the argument yellow, red, but apparently it was just a reckless as opposed to dangerous play.
Serious
play, but certainly his red was almost like a throwback to the old Luis. You could see his head completely went, he just dived into Kalashnikovs. And it could have actually been quite a serious injury.
Yeah, a resounding thwack. Heard around Stamford Bridge. There you go. It's a fine point for Arsenal. You mentioned the chaos. I'm not sure if that was the word you used, Rafa, on Thursday night against Cologne. Various differing angles have been offered to this. One kind of 20,000 Cologne fans on the rampage. Other people saying, no, actually, it was nice to get a bit of atmosphere for once in the Emirates. What kind of actually happened there?
Well, I mean, it very much depends on where you were, what you saw, how you were personally impacted by this. I mean, from the press box, which is a nice area to watch all this from, it looked just like good fun. I spoke to two Arsenal fans who were there. They absolutely loved the atmosphere. They were not themselves negatively affected. They fraternized with the Cologne fans. They told them to, you know, not overdo it, otherwise they get thrown out. And then some of them even got into arguments with other Arsenal fans who wanted them thrown out. And they said, come on, don't be stupid. You know, they're just there. So it really depends. I think what's my issue with some of the reporting, I think, is that it came up with this false narrative or idea that 20,000 Cologne fans stormed the Emirates. I mean, this simply didn't happen. There was one very half-hearted, very quick, very easily stamped out attempt to charge the barriers, and that's one of the videos you might have seen, but very quickly disperses. And then everybody, and it wasn't 20,000, it was probably 10,000, everybody waited patiently for an hour, and then they were all let in. So, you know, the idea that there was some kind of invasion or fans illegally got into the stadium is simply not true. Yes, under the letter of the law, they shouldn't have been able to buy these tickets, but they were bought from people selling these tickets. They weren't stolen from some kind of, you know, box office or something. So if they, as Arsenal press office said, if they acquired illegal tickets, then also the sale of those tickets was illegal. And I think that's really a harsh word to use for somebody who just, you know, wants to give his tickets to somebody else and who knows where they end up.
Absolutely. You have to say, when the game finally did get underway, it featured a couple of absolutely extraordinary goals, no?
Well, the opener.
Sanchez's.
Yeah. No, it was actually real fun game to watch. And there is no excuse for, you know, for fans trying to jump the barrier and getting impatient. There's no excuse for they threw a few bottles in Soho, but no one got hurt. I mean, they were just being a bit boisterous and a bit over the top. But I think, again, what's really key is here, and that's where all the comparisons with the 80s and all this kind of stuff are completely nonsensical, is the intention of these fans was just to get into the stadium and watch the game.
They didn't come
to beat anyone up. And I think that is a key... or even wind everybody up. I mean, there were no songs about Londoners, there were no songs about Arsenal, there were no songs about Germany or the war. I mean, all this kind of stuff, completely anathema. They were just sang about themselves all day. And one guy, a BBC reporter, reported Nazi salutes, which was then taken as justification just to smack these guys over the head, metaphorically, in some of the comments. But no one else saw it, and there were 10, maybe 15,000 people in London for 7-8 hours. Nobody else saw Nazi salutes apart from Robert Peston. So I don't know.
I think it's worth adding that. I think it's 80% of ultras in Germany are actually anti-racist. It's you know, foreign ultras culture is quite a left-wing sort of movement, if you like.
Anti-racist, pro-refugee.
Well, exactly. So, yeah. And I think you could see, I think there were pictures on Twitter of the banners of Köln supporting refugees and stuff like that. So, you know, when Peston says, oh, wait, that was a Nazi salute, everyone goes, ooh, I think, you know, I'm inclined to look on the side of, you know, the actual facts of what ultras movement is like in Germany. Yeah, of course, not without its problems. But also policing. I mean, they've noticed that there is lots of German fans in central London, and they haven't... It seemed to me that the police response was quite chaotic. I mean, I spoke to someone in Munich about, for example, policing around Bayern Anderlecht. They had 400 police there, they had 200 riot and 100 like special commando, and there was a few undercover officers there as well. Whereas in London, I wasn't quite sure. I mean, again, I wasn't at the game, but looking at the riot squad late arrival, I mean, I wasn't really sure that the English were as prepared as they should have been for just such an influx of funds. No, fans.
Actually, the police actually got changed into the riot gear at the stadium.
They were
outside changing. But, I mean, I'm hesitant to blame the police because they've got other stuff to worry about. One question I think that is worth discussing maybe briefly is this question about segregation that it throws up. Because again, I think we've come to the point where large numbers of fans in the home block are seen as something scandalous and dangerous and awful. And, you know, this is a shame somehow that they're there where they shouldn't be. And I think that's very, very sad and very wrong. I can understand why you don't necessarily want to mix Arsenal fans and Spurs fans at the Emirates or at the old White Hart Lane. But when it comes to games that clearly have very little riding and no rivalry, I think it's stupid not to take a very benevolent and relaxed view when there is absolutely no danger of anything happening. So I just don't necessarily think that the idea of strict segregation is I can understand the historic origins of it and why it's been introduced in England and in Great Britain, but I don't think it's necessarily something that needs to be strictly adhered to. Especially if Arsenal fans themselves, again, people I spoke to, they're very quick to mention to me that 10,000 of them went to Monaco and just sat. Obviously, Monaco, you know, as you know, James, never really the fullest and most atmospheric of grounds, but they all sat wherever they wanted to sit because right. They all officially had, I think, only a couple of thousand tickets. And of course, nobody bat an eyelid.
Yeah. Well, it'd be nice to see a world where there was no segregation whatsoever in any walk of life, I like to think, but equally in football matches. But I think, as you say, you can understand why with the historical precedents, there is this default attitude. And given that it's hard sometimes to know when problems are going to come, maybe that's why people are on the side of caution. But a very interesting point, and I think it's very positive that it's being raised, because it would be nice to move beyond those times of true tribalism. We'll have more interesting points, listeners, after this.
Tweet us at The Totally Show and find us on Facebook and at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
West Ham goalless at West Brom. Watford given what for by Man City. Spurs with their Wembley wobbles. And Palace. Which one to talk about next, Simon? Palace or Spurs?
I think we go Hodgson.
Do you?
Yeah.
Let's do this. I owe Southampton an apology because I thought that I somehow conjured up in my head some kind of new manager bounce at Selhurst Park. What was I thinking?
Yeah.
Are Saints better than... Because we were dubbing them last Thursday, potentially a Palace in the making. Mm. But they bounced back with a win here. Are they better than I thought, or was Palace just really bad?
Yeah, I think at the moment Palace, people say it's a confidence issue, but you look at the squad of players that they have, it's not a particularly good one, really.
It's the first side in English history to open a top-flight season with 5 defeats and no goals scored. Wow, they haven't found the back of the net in 6 consecutive league games. That's across 3 different managers. Mm. Wow. Going back to Sam Allardyce's days.
They've always, you know, the last 12, 18, well, since Pardew's been back there, they've always been really, you know, well, I don't want to say great, but like kind of, you know, potentially could beat any team in the league at various periods to a team that can't beat anybody in the league. And they're obviously in the latter stage at this moment. And, you know, I think there's this assumption that Hodgson's going to come in and just kind of, you know, rescue them. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to talk about a rescue job 5 games into the season, but, you know, I think he's got a lot of work to do there. I don't know whether he's got the defence to deal with it, because increasingly you've seen Scott Dan, who I think is quite good actually, but he suffers from injuries. He's not there often enough.
Sasha.
They did have 2 glaring misses against Southampton, and
much as they'd had glaring misses against Burnley in the previous game,
right? Yeah, but literally the chances should have been buried.
Yeah,
I think Benteke was punching with the other one. So it's, I mean, Southampton, I think, are going to be quite a dour watch this season. If you look by past experience, what Pellegrino's done, say at Alaves, though not necessarily what he did in South America, but the game on Saturday, I think Crystal Palace could have got a draw. I'm not sure there will be a Hodgson bounce. I don't think he's that type of character.
Well, maybe
it's also down to his, you know, notoriously not very fun methods, and once he puts
the players must be confused though, mustn't they, at the moment, about what they're expected to do, because they've gone from Pardew to Allardyce to De Boer to Hodgson, you know, the opposite. I'm actually pounding the desk there to try and emphasise the point. And, you know, from the players' point of view, they seem to be asked one thing, you know, and then a totally different thing. I mean,
You could tell the difference that Southampton, who weren't very exciting and weren't very convincing when they had the ball, you could see that there was a sort of pattern to their game and something that they wanted to do, and they kept it quite nicely. And individually, they weren't that great, but they had some kind of idea, whereas Palace was just like one guy starts running, looks up, and then, you know, what I'm going to do, okay, I'll put a cross in, maybe somebody is there. I mean, it was just so
early
erratic.
Days, of course, though, in the Hodgson reign.
Yeah.
Early days. Fred the Leopard says, after 5 no scoring defeats, how likely is it that Palace will set new low points total for the Premier League? Well, intriguingly, their next 4 matches are against the top 4. That's Man City away, Man United away, Chelsea at home, and then Newcastle away. Newcastle, yes, up in 4th place, Sasha.
3-1s in the bounce.
Yeah.
For the first time in ages.
Lascelles again with the winner. Do you know, all 4 of his Premier League goals have been headers from corners. He has a special set of skills, as people on podcasts like to say. There you go. Andrew Lowe says, I reckon Newcastle need 9 wins out of 33 games. Can they do it and stay up? Phil Wheatie also has questions. Can Newcastle sustain a push for European football? It's going to be a short answer, I suspect.
Do they need to?
From my Ashley's point of view. Nice if you can.
Mike Ashley doesn't really care about European football, does he?
Oh, that's fair. All right. Dave Newton again.
Oh, yeah, true.
Dave Newton with a more general point. Are we benefited from playing poor teams, or are we a genuinely good Rafa side?
I think, you know, Rafa Benitez is usually at his best when he's got some kind of conflict. And, you know, there's a common enemy. Towards the end of his time at Liverpool, I think that common enemy became a bit too much. But, you know, when his back's against the wall, he usually comes up with answers. And, you know, after the first couple of games of the season, it looked like it was going to be a long, hard season for Newcastle. I mean, I don't think he's got the players to do it, to be honest. But, you know, with him, that the team will be organised. So, you know, they will win a fair number of games. I think Newcastle will stay up, but whether they'll push for Europe's a different question.
Sasha, Spurs fans are eager for us to talk about them, but throw in a final thing on Newcastle if you want.
Just very much looking forward to Newcastle-Liverpool in a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah?
Going to go up for that, to see what Rafa can do against Liverpool.
Yeah. I do feel that space behind the top 4, 5, 6, maybe, is very, very open. You know, the teams that you'd expect to make it their own kind of natural habitat, Everton, Southampton, West Ham, maybe after last season, they're nowhere near there. So who knows? I mean, Newcastle could just get a few points more and
there you go,
get into that sort of area.
All right, Spurs then. just when you thought it was safe to go back to Wembley. Eh? They failed to score for the first time in 30 Premier League home games. Last year, 17 wins out of 19 at home. This year, none. And they did everything they could, no? 26 shots.
Just didn't do very well.
Kane hit the bar again. Do you know he's had more shots this season on his own than Swansea have? Swansea have failed to register. I've got more of these. Failed to register a single shot on target for the third time in their five Premier League games this season. Ian McIntosh says Swansea was shipping three a game when Paul Clement arrived. It's fair to say he's fixed that now. Is that fair, or was it just wasteful from Spurs?
No, I thought they looked very solid. I mean, look, if you have eight men behind the ball, you tend to be fairly solid and hard to break down. It takes a bit more ingenuity and something a little bit special in the final third that Spurs, for whatever reason, just couldn't produce. I mean, it might have to do with Wembley, but it could just easily have to do with the fact that they had a very, very hard game in midweek, which really took a lot out of them. And that depth, which they undoubtedly have, I think, at the back and in midfield, perhaps isn't quite there up front. I mean, Llorente came on fairly anonymous. They don't have players of the quality in the final third that you think, you know, somebody will come on and will produce something special.
I mean, Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, you have Son and you have Eriksen, who have more individual moments of brilliance, but they are not consistently amazing performers the way that United and City and even Chelsea have at this level.
Do you think they need something that is completely the opposite of Kane, or something that is similar to him, to have that alternative option? Because obviously Llorente is a totally different player, really, isn't he?
It's different, but in a way similar, because he is he's a target man of some sort. I mean, I would like to see somebody maybe behind.
Vincent Janssen
scored at the weekend.
Did he score at the weekend?
Fenerbahce.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they think that with Dele Alli, they have a second striker on the pitch. Mm. It's just Alli had a very poor individual game and was not a factor.
It can happen. Also, Kane's about as reliable as you can get, usually, as long as it's not August.
I wouldn't read too much into it. I mean, Swansea look very, very awkward to play against. And coming back to the original point, I think my guess is they'll frustrate a few more really good sides this season. So. Mm.
All right.
Maybe,
well,
just
more
a sign of their competence.
Right.
I think that's 7 points dropped by Spurs at home this season. Four points dropped all of last season.
Wow.
Yeah, but this is not home.
More London teams who didn't score included West Ham away at West Brom in a match which saw Gareth Barry equaling Ryan Giggs' Premier League record of 632 appearances in the competition. He started 600 out of those 632. That is impressive from Gareth Barry. Also, Huddersfield and Leicester enjoyed a 1-1 draw. Leicester have only had one win in their last eight Premier League fixtures. Interesting. Bournemouth got their first win of the season 2-1 against Brighton. And the Seagulls will have the opportunity to gain revenge literally tomorrow, Tuesday, when the two sides will be meeting again at the Vitality Stadium in the third round of the EFL Cup. Sasha.
Jordan Ibe finally did something.
Yeah, what did he do, though?
He did two assists. Mm, he came on and turned the game.
Yeah, that back heel, that was a joyous little one. And also the outside of his boot.
For the last one. I mean, he's been such a disappointment at Bournemouth for everybody concerned. I mean, I think you could see why Klopp got rid of him last year. And I think they've just been waiting for him to do something like this, and he finally actually produced. I don't think he's actually had a single assist in any of his previous games for Bournemouth. Also, I think, interesting situation of, you know, club goes on a losing run, and perhaps different attitudes at different clubs, say maybe Everton or say Palace sack the manager. None of that at Bournemouth. I mean, it's very, very level-headed, very, almost maybe too reliant on Howe, but I don't think he was under any sort of pressure after those results. They actually looked at the fixtures that they had, and these were awkward opponents for Howe. West Brom, Watford, they were particularly gutted about Watford, not a very pretty side. Of course, City, they were a bit unfortunate, and at Arsenal, they always lose. So they kind of looked at those games and went, well, maybe we might get a point out of these. Mm. But if we lose all four, it's not the end of the world. However, I think it was a bit worrying about how sort of stuck they got against Brighton, but this is where I brought to the rescue.
He certainly did. And that just leaves the exciting Liverpool, who enjoyed a draw with Burnley. It's fair to say, I think, that Burnley came as close to winning this game as the home side did, would you say, Sasha?
Well, there was that double corner, first part of which was Clavin again getting now jumped. But I think overall, I mean, Liverpool had the chance to win it at the end as well, but I think, you know, it's, as Simon said before the podcast, you know, coming back to the thing that's been haunting Liverpool the last 15 years, this defending issue.
It's not just Klopp, you know, it goes back until the mid-90s, really. Apart, you know, the way periods, I suppose, under Julio and Benitez, where they sorted the defence out, but that was at the expense of a more attacking team. So they've never quite got that balance right over a long period of time. And I think the manager that does get the balance right will be the one that eventually cracks it. I know it's an obvious thing to say, but the concern with Liverpool is Dortmund team didn't necessarily play with a certain amount of control, but Liverpool never look like they're in control of the destiny at all. And I think that's what feeds into the crowd's kind of anxiety. I mean, there's chronic anxiety at Anfield at the moment.
It's a poor run of results, isn't it? Yeah. 5-0 with the extenuating circumstance of the red card, then the 2-2 draw midweek in the Champions League, and now this 1-1 draw with a Burnley side who hadn't picked up any points at Anfield in a league match since 1974.
But they have beaten Chelsea earlier this season.
Well, yeah, and they drew at Spurs, so there's something going on there with Burnley. Like, a team that had been famous for its home form now struggles a little bit at home, but is terrific on the road. And I'm not sure that they've changed their football at all, have they, Sean Dyche?
I think they've got a bit more experience in the team. They've recruited quite well again. You know, I think selling Andre Gray was a good decision, and bringing in Chris Wood, a good decision. You know, he scored and contributed to with assists already. I think they're just building slowly, you know, and have just improved. You know, I think that might explain it as well. You know, the funny thing with Sean Dyche, he's always so defensive about the way he plays.
Has he got a chapter in your book?
He does, yeah.
All right, what's the chapter called?
It's called Little Old Burnley.
All right.
He refers to Burnley constantly as Little Old Burnley, and I just think it kind of creates this... I don't know whether it's a deliberate thing on his part to say it. I just think it creates this impression of him,
right,
which probably isn't favourable, you know, amongst most people who listen to him. But you know, that it's fair to say.
How did you find him in person then?
Well, I didn't have to ask very many questions, to be honest. He just spoke a lot, which was great. I can't complain with that. And a lot of it was quite interesting, relevant stuff. I mean, the problem is now in journalism, I suppose, you know, there's this kind of way of, well, the manager's not really like that. He's actually the opposite of what he's... The reality is he's in the middle of what probably people think of him. You know, he's obviously pragmatic. He's only got certain... I think he realises that Burnley have to play like that to get results, ultimately. But he is very defensive about, like, the accusation that he plays long ball football. And, you know, at Anfield on Saturday, he did play long ball football. But who cares, really, that they got a good result? I mean, yeah. I think if he has aspirations of going to another club, you know, with slightly more, well, slightly bigger aspirations, he probably does have to need to find a way for that style to evolve. I mean, you look at Sam Allardyce, for example, when he first became the Bolton manager, they were long ball. And then over a number of years, they did evolve to some extent. They had better players. They did play some slightly more creative football at times, but that tag still stuck. So he's getting to that stage now where he probably has to find a slightly different way of doing things if he wants to progress himself.
He doesn't want to be Big Sean.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think he wants to be anything different. I think that his problem is that he's not getting the recognition for doing very well results-wise relative to the stuff he has to work with.
His name was Sean Dyche-Nyo.
Exactly.
We just spoke about... Sorry to cut you off, but we spoke about Bournemouth there. I think he likes Eddie Howe. He spoke quite openly about, you know, his respect for him. But I think Eddie Howe seems to get a lot more respect within the English game than Dyche does when...
But probably, to borrow your question from earlier, you'd probably rather watch Bournemouth than Burnley, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But perhaps not when you're losing 3-0 at Arsenal every year.
Oh, yeah. It depends if you're neutral or not. Who was of all the people you spoke to for your book, On the Brink, English Football, Journey Through English Football's Northwest, who was the nicest person you spoke to?
Nicest person?
Was there somebody who surprised you for how nice they were, you know? Or who was the most different to their public persona?
Well, I mean, I found Gary Neville to be exactly how I expected him, to be honest. But, you know... I quite like people like that, to be honest, who've got a bit of drive and a bit of needle in them and will challenge you if you say something. I don't mind a bit of arguing, actually, in interviews. It's quite good. But the nicest person, that's a tricky one. I like Joe.
All right, let me ask you a separate question.
Palios.
Okay.
I think he's a very decent person and got, you know, really good ideas about football. But, you know, I think it's a shame that the with it, because of what happened with the FA, it kind of just gets disregarded. You know, there's that tendency in football, if you have one big PR gaffe, that's it, you're finished. Whereas you've actually got quite a lot of good ideas.
My other question was going to be this. Is it true that the first report you ever filed at Southport was about UFOs?
This is correct.
Brilliant. All right, what happened?
It wasn't the only UFO sighting in Southport.
What was the sighting?
I'm trying to think. I think it was over Marshside, which is like to the north of Southport. And, you know, a lot of marshes, as you'd expect. And I had to ring up the local UFO expert who confirmed to me that it was a UFO. So this actually made the paper, UFO in Southport. Yeah.
Were there any pictures or anything?
No.
Was football being played at the time?
There was no football. Okay. I mean, Southport is that kind of place.
Where you see UFOs, is it? Because there are certain kind of geographical locations around the world where the incidence is just that much higher. There's a mountain in Minas Gerais in Brazil. There's also a town where one of the most famous for ufologists, one of the most famous kind of UFO crashes is supposed to happen. I think it's called Vargem Grande, and they supposedly the Brazilian military arrived and there was an injured alien and stuff. When we get our Totally Alien podcast up, we're going to go into all this stuff in depth. Have you got any great Russian UFO
stories? Well, Siberia, obviously the Tunguska meteorite was a UFO crashing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Right. Brilliant.
Can I just finish off with my little Southport story?
Oh, yeah, sure.
There was one rational explanation for this UFO, because just over the Ribble Estuary, they've got they're making those typhoon aeroplane, you know, like kind of those, I don't know,
fighter jets.
Yeah, and I think that was where that's
but they always help with it's the military experiment,
but it is just over the way, so you know, could have been, who knows.
But
anyway,
shall we talk a bit more about Liverpool, or is that
did you want to talk more about Liverpool, Rafa? You got a Klopp book coming up, why don't you save it for that? When's your Klopp book out?
Mid-November.
All right,
James.
Then. Still waiting for him to sort that defence out, as Simon was saying. I know you feel it's only a matter of time, yes?
History would suggest it is. I mean, look, I think I can understand if I was a Liverpool supporter or a supporter of any big team, I'd want my team to be super exciting up front and super solid at the back and winning every game. Yes, that is the ideal scenario. He's clearly not quite there yet, but
and he clearly agrees, which is why he was out after Van Dijk.
Yeah, I think this is where the frustration comes into it. I think whatever Klopp does on the training ground, I think we can all agree that more individual quality at the back would not have hurt them this summer, especially after adding considerable quality in other positions. And here, I think, is where the frustration comes in, that whoever's really ultimately responsible for identifying alternatives to Virgil van Dijk did not have a viable alternative. And I think that is something of a club of the size of Liverpool and of their financial ability and reach. That, I think, is a very unsatisfactory answer.
Fair enough.
I think that's a big problem going forward.
Well, we could talk about this for hours, couldn't we? But after this, we're getting a visit from Ian McIntosh with the latest from bits of the Football League, and then we're going to be casting our eye over further flung frontiers of football. Listeners, if you want your face to be as smooth as the sounds here at our new home, Jazz FM, then you need to noodle on to cornerstone.co.uk pronto. Cornerstone take all the hassle out of shaving. Let them know how often you defuzz and sign up to one of their plans, and you'll never have to worry about running out of blades ever again. They'll deliver them right to your door. To get you started, head to cornerstone.co.uk/totally and you'll receive a personally engraved razor and 6 super sharp blades for just £4. That's cornerstone.co.uk/totally. Nice. Hello, Ian McIntosh.
Hello.
Right. Now, Football League this weekend is going to get its very own podcast as of tomorrow.
Certainly is.
You're going to be joined by former Birmingham and Villa manager Alex McLeish in the studio. You're going to get behind the scenes from Millwall Leeds, which saw Leeds' terrific run ended. You're going to be focusing on Exeter and Oxford. Good Lord, so much stuff. Listeners, subscribe now. It's called the Totally Football League Show. Save your League One and League Two chat, much as I'd like to hear it for that podcast, Ian. And Leeds, having spoken of Birmingham and Villa, with the latest shock news at, well, particularly Birmingham, where Harry Redknapp's gone.
Yeah, that was that was a little unexpected. I mean, we'd spoken a number of times about how badly Birmingham were doing, but in midweek they played Leeds and they were beaten 2-0, but they actually played quite well. There was far more shape and general idea. And at half-time they were one up against Preston, who were looking very decent this side. And they were looking so good that I said to the BBC's Alistair Bruce Ball, it looks like Harry's turned it around at last.
Well, you'd be forgiven for thinking so. Preston, after all, hadn't won away in their last 15 away games. But then in the space of 11 minutes, what happened?
Boom. Suddenly, Preston were 3-1 up. And wow. Birmingham, by all accounts, including Redknapp's own account, just went to pieces completely. Now, this is very, very awkward because Birmingham has spent a lot of money by Championship standards. I mean, they spent the better part of £12 million on half the Brentford team just in the week before transfer deadline day. Redknapp had been saying all the way through the season, he hasn't got the players, it's not the team he wants, he hasn't got the players, then he gets the players and he's gone almost instantly. So while there is genuine, justifiable criticism to be directed at Redknapp, you're also looking at the Birmingham owners and thinking, have you really got the clearest idea? I mean, this is the ownership which sacked Gary Rowett when they were in seventh and replaced him with Zola, who did not leave them in seventh.
No, they've won 6 games out of the 38 matches they've played since Gary Rowett went. Who's going to take over full-time?
Right now, it's anybody's guess. You would imagine, given the way this the owners have worked so far, that it will be someone possibly more... With more of a name than an appropriate skill set.
If I may just butt in on the owners there. They bought Les Ambassadeurs Casino in London last week. And there has been perhaps a suggestion that maybe they might not be that interested in Birmingham City for much longer.
Right.
And given how they've been running the club for the last year, maybe they haven't been that interested in the first place. But it obviously looks they don't really have much of an idea how to run a football club. So I wouldn't be surprised if they move on. I think it's also in the general context of what's happening in China at the moment and football ownership. The messages from Beijing are very, very mixed. And for example, Suning and Wanda are getting a kicking, and it's a sort of uncertain which way the whole Chinese football investment is going to go forward.
Because the government are increasingly down on people pumping their money into propping up kind of ludicrous follies abroad.
Well, I think this is how it's being presented. But for example, Suning and Wanda are actually reasonably sensible, but no one can really see where it's going to pan out in 2-3 months because the government position keeps changing.
That's interesting. A little bit of geopolitics for you there.
See why we need a whole show for this, can't you?
Yeah. Absolutely. Hey, something novel for Steve Bruce. Hey,
a win.
Yeah, they won.
Yeah, 3-0 away at Barnsley.
But, novel, Steve Bruce.
See, it went straight over my head. Yes, 3-0 away from Barnsley. So that just really rubs it in for the Birmingham fans. Not only are they in trouble, but Villa are powering up to mid-table. And you would expect them to kind of build on that. That's certainly what Bruce said. But interesting news for Barnsley as well, their takeover is almost complete.
Who's taking them over?
One Billy Bean of Moneyball.
You're kidding?
No.
And listening to football podcasts in general.
Does he?
He's a minority shareholder.
Yes, along with a consortium from which country?
China.
China, of course.
Billy previously, and hello to you if you're listening, Billy, had a position at a Dutch club, and I can't remember which one. Altmar. And now Sasha, who's sharing a microphone excitingly at the moment with Ian. Ian, can you just swivel the microphone back to Sasha? He's got something to say.
I think for the Chinese, the interesting thing with Barnsley is that they're effectively getting it on the cheap, and Barnsley got plenty of assets.
All right. Are they building infrastructure as well?
Infrastructure in Barnsley? Not convinced.
Okay. They've
got quite a good scouting record of the ploughing through the lower leagues and non-league. They've had some good players come through there. Maybe it'll continue. John Stones, yeah.
Bingo. You can see why the Chinese are licking their lips over that. Elsewhere, I mentioned Leeds getting their first defeat of the season, but they're still top.
Yep, still top, just about on goal difference. No one saw that one coming at all. Millwall had only won one game thus far this season against Norwich. Leeds have just looked imperious throughout the season. and had been at several games without conceding a goal. I think it was up to six by the time they went down. So incredible result from Millwall. We had Matt Stanger there on behalf of the new show.
Oh, yeah. What's it called again?
Totally Football League Show. You can subscribe to that now on iTunes.
Would you be talking about Cardiff drawing 1-1 with Sheffield Wednesday, a result which enabled Wolves to move into second place because they beat Forest 2-1?
We'll be talking about it a little bit, but we're not going to be one of those traditionally structured Football League shows. Okay. We're not going to start at the top and work our way all the way through 72 different narratives. We're all just going to tell a handful of stories.
Ooh, all right, and hopefully you are going to talk, maybe you can now actually, a little taster, of the 1-1 draw between Hull and Sunderland. All sorts of problems for Leonard Slutsky. Oh, yeah. Sasha, you're his best mate in England. How's he feeling?
I think he's rather stressed. I mean, I didn't watch the Sunderland game particularly closely, but I did go to the Fulham game. And I thought initially he went very defensively 5-4-1 because they got hammered at Derby 5-0 after a series of mistakes by Hector. But he, I think, essentially went with the same formation against Sunderland and then mixed it up to a 4-2-3-1 second half. They came back. I think he, at the moment, it might look from the outside that he's perhaps chopping and changing his formation a little bit too much, but he does have a limited number of players. And what he does quite well, I think he's adapting within the game. Mm. Even like if it's not particularly good first half, as he described the first half against something that's terrible, then he can make enough changes to outmanage a lot of the managers in the Championship. And for example, against Fulham, who are a very good team, he basically went head to head last 15 minutes when he went to four at the back, where back and forth, gung-ho, proper Championship. So he's definitely embracing it, but I think it's pretty stressful.
All right, has he still got that smile on his face that we saw earlier in the season?
I haven't seen the smile for a while.
Oh, that's a shame, isn't it? Ian, anything else?
Only to say you can subscribe to the Totally Football League Show on iTunes, and so many of you did last week that it bounced all the way to number 2 in the iTunes charts, which isn't bad for a podcast that hasn't had an episode yet.
Right, the iTunes charts actually weighted towards new subscribers, so if you launch something, it just goes straight.
Don't ruin this with science.
No, but it's that's nice.
Experts.
All right, looking forward to that on Tuesday. Do you want to stick around for the rest of the show? Sasha's going to be doing more geopolitics.
You know what? I'll only bring it down.
Okay. Rafa is going to talk about Germany. Simon's going to say loads of stuff. I'm not going to talk about Italy because we're going to... Do you know what? There's so much stuff happened in Italy.
16-year-old.
It needs its own podcast. But until that happens, we'll have to wait till Thursday to tell you all about the 16-year-old who scored a brace on Sunday night in that incredible 3-2 match between Genoa and Lazio. Lazio coming out winners there to maintain their position just behind the leading three, which are Inter, Napoli and Juventus, have all made perfect starts. Speaking about Juventus, we'll also tell you on Thursday about how Paulo Dybala has now scored as many goals on his own as the bottom five clubs put together. What? And we'll also be describing what's happened in the midweek round of games, because they're having an English avoc, as they call it in Italy. Rafa, they've got a midweek round of fixtures. Same thing's going to happen in Germany, isn't it? In the Bundesliga?
Yes.
All right, then. Ahead of the midweek round of matches that's going to take place in the Bundesliga, I see Hannover in second place there. Newly promoted hangover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Giving Hamburger a hangover, you might say, on Friday. 2-0 win. Yeah, I always think hamburgers go very well with a Hannover.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No, Thorsten Lieberknecht is doing extremely well there. With a newly promoted side. I tipped them to go down. I mean, they might still...
Early days, roughly.
Yeah, I know, they might still, but they've done very well.
Question from Kenneth Ertner. After Robin's celebration, is Bayern back to being FC Hollywood? Or is this crisis just a minor bump in the road? What did Robin do?
I don't know exactly what he's referring to. I mean, Robin was very... was being a bit of a team player, uncharacteristically. Right. He kissed Ribéry when he came off.
Okay.
Which was nice to see.
Mm-hmm. And, also because Ribéry gets really grumpy when he comes off, doesn't he?
Yeah, but this was the other way around. Robin off and Ribéry came on. If anything, the result and the manner of the performance and everybody very clearly, I think, having had a few days to reflect on Bayern falling apart a little bit as a team, they got to the point where you could see it from some of the stuff that Müller said, where they kind of sat together and said, we have to sort this out. We can no longer just all play out an individual game and just look after ourselves, because we will not be successful. So they've had a bit of a clearing the air kind of talk, and they play with a lot more energy and commitment, and they absolutely destroyed a team that just individually wasn't on the same level.
4-0 win against Mainz, another two goals for Lewandowski, that takes him to 88 goals in 100 Bundesliga games for Bayern. since arriving on a free, which is very impressive. They're up to third place now. So Dortmund still top, and then, as we mentioned, the surprising Hannover in second place, and a full round of fixtures on the way. Was there anything else about Germany that you wanted to throw in? We've only got 4 minutes left.
Red card for Naby Keita.
Oh, yeah.
For a high challenge.
Ah.
3 week ban. Ooh. Very, very Mane-esque. And a similar incident involving a goalkeeper, Koen Castells, who knocked out Christian Gentner of Stuttgart. Gentner broke 3 bones in his face.
Ooh. And suffered a concussion. How did he knock him out?
With his knee. Ooh. By going for a ball.
Schumacher-esque.
No, because Schumacher, of course, completely missed the ball and just went through Battiston. Now, this was one of those sort of very modern goalkeeping moves where they just put up a knee to protect themselves, but also to really tell players to get out of the way. Gentner wasn't really involved in the whole thing. Goalkeeper didn't really see him, but knocked him out cold. And VAR did not get involved. And by most common observers, judgment, that was a clear case of reckless, at least reckless foul. He should have at least had a yellow card. As it was, nothing was given.
All right, fair enough. Only got a couple of minutes left to tell you that they've also been busy in Spain. Of course, they've got a midweek round there. Barcelona came from behind to win at Getafe. Paulinho with the winning goal there. But Dembele, Ousmane Dembele, going out injured. They're talking of 3 to 4 months out, which is a huge disappointment given the amount of money they've just...
outpour of sympathy in Dortmund. There were fan choreographies and people...
That's harsh. That's harsh. Real won. Atletico won it there. You might call it the wonder of the world. Then you wonder Metropolitano, which I was a little bit disappointed. You build a new stadium. It just looks like generic... It looks like generic FIFA stadium where, you know, where they haven't bothered to... It looks like a... It
looks a bit unfinished as well.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of nowhere as well, isn't it? I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
Nowhere to have a drink.
Boo. In a second or two, we'll get to finish off a little bit of an update on events in Scotland. First, though, Sasha, what's the situation in Russia regarding a couple of clubs who Premier League sides are going to be facing soon? Specifically, Spartak, who had big problems, it looked like, in with kind of off-field discipline and crowd trouble and that in their clash in the Champions League with Maribor last week, and CSKA, who might have one or two geopolitical headaches.
Well, actually, both clubs have a couple of geopolitical headaches. I'll start off with Spartak. Their latest run out in the league finished with the manager going into the dressing room and going, "Do you want me to leave? Are you doing this on purpose?"
What did the player say?
Well, the player, no one, it hasn't been reported what the player said.
So this is Massimo Carrera. We've kind of dubbed Antonio Conte light.
He does apparently still keep in touch with him and, you know, goes through a few tactical tweaks here and there. And, you know, he went back to the 3-5-2.
Well, they won the championship last year, so what's the problem?
Basically, they won the championship rather than unexpectedly. I mean, the situation has already been compared to Leicester. For Spartak to wait for 16 years for the title is a bit like Leicester waiting their whole lives. Over the summer, it's been a conflict between effectively the new director of football in terms of signings and Carrera, breakdown in communication, like rows over bonuses. And effectively, they only signed 3 players. One of them is Pašalić on loan from Chelsea. And another guy, they tried to pick up Luan from Gremio, and instead they got Pedro Rocha as a kind of cut price replacement. So they have been blowing 2-goal leads left, right and centre, and this happened for the third time on Sunday against Tosno, newly promoted Tosno, where they threw away a 2-goal lead against 10 men in the last 5 minutes.
Is it on purpose, Sasha?
Well, it's just a lack of concentration, I think, and it's just basically, I think once the going gets a little bit tough, it looks like the team actually gives up. At Maribor, whom they should have really beaten quite easily, there were a couple of horrendous defensive lapses by Yeshenko on the right side of the 3-5-2, and Maribor could have actually won that game. Mm. On top of that, as you alluded to, there was a bit of crowd trouble. Now, beforehand, there was videos of people running around fighting the police in Maribor. Those aren't actually, for a change, they weren't the Russians.
Right.
Those were the Slovenians trying to get at the Russians, but the police
stopped. Was it the Spartak fans who fired the rocket at the referee?
However, it was definitely the Spartak fans who fired the rocket at the referee, although there has been some suggestion, Rawls' eyes, that it was the Serbs in the Spartak crowd who did it, because there's a friendship between Spartak Moscow and Crvena Zvezda, so they came over. However, apparently there's a guy locked up, and he's facing perhaps 5 years. Ooh. The flare gate will come before UEFA on the 21st of September. I don't think the Liverpool game in Moscow is in danger. However, Spartak probably should get some sort of a suspended sentence and a fine.
You fancy Liverpool's chances away at Spartak?
I think Spartak will get absolutely destroyed, given how they're playing at the moment. Also, just to mention a couple of things off the pitch, why perhaps they're throwing the money around. Otkritie, the sponsors of the stadium, have just been taken over by Central Bank because, oops, where's the money gone? IFD Capital, run by Fidun, the owner, went under sanctions this summer because they've taken over a hotel group in Crimea. So the money is a little bit tight.
And hang on, so if you take over a hotel group in Crimea, you get sanctioned by...
US sanctions.
Oh, I see.
Because it's
right, because that they
because
shouldn't
be... Because that thing, yeah. That they did.
That whole Ukraine thing.
Oh, that's part of the whole Ukraine thing.
Right, okay.
And also part of this whole Ukraine thing is perhaps allows us to come to CSKA Moscow. Their stadium sponsor, VEB Bank, is also under sanctions since 2014 for the reasons of Ukraine. Giner, the owner, has a lot of energy and hotel interests in Ukraine. Now, interestingly enough, over the weekend, this annual meeting was happening. It's called Yes Ukraine. So basically, Ukrainians speaking.
Yes Ukraine.
Yes Ukraine. Speaking to the Western partners.
Didn't Obama have that? Yes. Oh, no, that was. Yeah, but go on.
So they had David Cameron there, for example, complaining about dangers of populism. John Kerry saying that the way Russia is behaving in its foreign policy at the moment is probably a function of how Russia was treated in the 90s. But interestingly enough, with implications for CSK, it's what Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, said. He was basically talking about isolating Ukraine from Russia and for a greater energy union with the EU. And I think this will hit Giner and his interests in Ukraine.
So this is the Ukraine people want to have a greater energy collaboration with Europe.
Rather than the other side.
Right, okay.
So I think Giner will be affected by this. I haven't read anything in Russian press, but I think you have to put two and two together, and I think money will be even tighter at CSKA. Now, in terms of on the pitch, they got a surprising result at Benfica, whom they beat 2-1 in the Champions League. I mean, people were amazed. They got a soft penalty, but they built on it. And actually, a young player who came, you know, who they got early, didn't buy him this summer. Jamal Dinov came on and got the win on rebound. Now, in terms of players being tired from European games, now, CSKA got back to Moscow on Wednesday at 8 o'clock in the morning. 5-hour flight, 2-hour time difference. And they were very, very tired for Rostov, even though publicly, you know, we're in great shape and stuff. But they basically endured through Rostov game at the weekend. They beat them 2-0. And they're actually up to fourth now. So whilst on the one hand no one at CSKA thinks they're going to beat Manchester United because they're way too experienced and old for that, they are perhaps to be taken more seriously than Spartak Moscow are at the moment.
Interesting. Sasha, that was fascinating. Little roundup there. One or two things in Russia. Can I just throw this in from Johnny Blaine, who mentions it in the Swiss Cup. Young boys beat old boys this weekend 4-0. It's nice. From boys to boys, as we go beyond the wall, as our man Jim Burt returns with another hot take on Celtic, Rangers and the rest of the goings-on north of the border.
The weekend kicked off on Friday when Rangers hopped across the river to play their other Glasgow rivals, Partick Thistle, in the knowledge that a good win would see them potentially top of the table. But to reference the manager's press conference the other week, it appears either the dog stopped barking or the caravan stopped moving and Rangers were held to a draw at Fir Hill. This gave the Harry Rags, who were reduced to 10 men, only their second point of the season. The fixtures on Saturday did bring a degree of comfort to Kuchina in that Aberdeen unexpectedly dropped a point at home against Kilmarnock, who similarly doubled their points tally with a 1-1 draw at Pittodrie. Rangers could have found themselves fifth in a table of 12 had St Johnson overcome Dundee at Dens Park, but they went down to the odd goal in five, with Saints manager Tommy Wright less than impressed with the referee performance, who he felt denied his side at least a point. As was discussed in this very podcast, there was a lot of talk about Northern Ireland manager Michael O'Neill and questions asked about why his name is never mentioned when decent-sized jobs become available. And arguably the same could be said for his fellow countryman Wright. He's been at Saints 6 years, won the Scottish Cup and guided them to top four finishes in the last three seasons. All this on a budget equivalent to a stick of rock in a balloon. That said, he may find his name thrown about this weekend as it sees the first old firm clash of the season. Ominously for Rangers, Celtic recovered from their shoeing from the team with the massive wage bill, PSG, by handing out a 4-0 hiding to Ross County, over whom they have an equally huge financial advantage. While the performance was concerning enough for their opponents, the return to the starting 11 and goal-scoring fun by Moussa Dembele isn't what the Ibrox men want to hear. Despite it being so early in the season, if there's a repeat of the last meeting at Ibrox, where Celtic won comfortably, there could well be a clamour for change of manager. This fixture is big enough without the added pressure of a sack hanging over you. Now, the names of Wright, McLeish and even possibly Billy Davis could find their way into some of the reports next Sunday if the game and the result goes Celtic's way. The only crumb of comfort for Rangers fans, I suppose, is that Davy Moyes' glorious Celtic career is probably enough to stop his name getting thrown in the mix. I think even supporters of the other SPL clubs wouldn't wish that on them.
Excellent work there from Jim Burke. Many thanks to Rafa, Simon and Sasha for being with us today. We'll be back on Thursday for another edition of the Totally Football Show, the Totally Football League Show. We'll be with you on Tuesday. Happy listening, and we'll speak to you soon.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com and tweet us @thetotallyshow.